Hey, I'm Jessica Valenti, Guardian columnist, and this is What Would a Feminist Do? As numbers roll in just 3 days after the Women's March on Washington, it's estimated that millions of people worldwide marched on Saturday, Trump's first full day in office. And though the Trump administration has been dismissive of the protests, we know that, much to Trump's annoyance, the protest numbers dwarfed his inauguration numbers by many, many, many times over. People marched for all sorts of reasons. They marched for women's rights, for racial justice, immigrant rights, trans rights. They marched against the Trump agenda and for equality. Both men and women across the globe came together in an act of mass catharsis, really, and solidarity to bring their individual messages together. And I was there in D.C., and I had a chance to talk with some of these people.
Can you tell me why you all are out here today?
As a young woman, it's really kind of terrifying to know that someone is about to undo so many wonderful things that Obama did. I mean, yesterday they refreshed the White House official page and the healthcare page was gone, the LGBTQ page was gone.
So why are you here? Why are you protesting?
I feel like it's more like a march for solidarity with sort of women's rights as human rights.
There you go.
There's this sense that women's bodies belong to men.
Yeah.
And that's what Donald Trump has sort of made his position clear about.
I just ran into Stephanie, and Stephanie actually gave me the tattoo that I have on my middle finger of the woman symbol, and so it was pretty serendipitous, I think, that we ran into each other. So what are you doing here today?
I am here to stand in for all the women that couldn't make it. They couldn't leave their jobs and come here, or were too far away.
Okay, I'm Caitlin. I'm 25, and I'm from Toledo, Ohio.
I'm Emily. I'm
23.
I'm 23, sorry, I forgot. And I'm from Toledo, Ohio.
So why are you guys here today?
To make America nasty again, man.
But while Saturday was exhilarating and record-shattering, the question people seem to keep asking over and over is, how do we keep the momentum going now that the excitement of the march is over? To talk about this, I'm joined by Jamia Wilson, activist and executive director of Women, Action, and the Media.
I think that we need to continue having conversations like these, surfacing and also highlighting the work of marginalized communities and their issues.
But first, a short rant. On the day of the march, when I went back to my hotel room to write my column and watch the news and see the coverage of the march, I noticed that more than a few pundits, and Republicans especially, kept criticizing the protests by saying that the protesters didn't know what we were marching for. And I think what's actually closer to the truth is that they didn't understand what we were marching for. Because there wasn't one set list of demands or a policy proposal. That's true. You know, people were there for all sorts of reasons. But media pundits and political analysts don't necessarily understand the nuances of the modern feminist movement. We care about reproductive rights and justice, but also racial justice and how those things connect. We want violence against women to stop, and we want trans rights front and center, and we want to talk about how those things inform each other, right? These are not singular issues that can be described in a 30-second media hit, and that's okay. And I think in a lot of ways that's better. These aren't simple times. These aren't simple issues. That doesn't mean that we don't know what we're fighting for. It means that you don't care enough to do a deep dive to find out. To talk about this, I'm joined by Jamia Wilson, activist and executive director of Women, Action, and the Media. Hello. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. We were just talking about how exhausted we were. It's a few days after the march and yet still we're tired and worn down.
Yes. Yes. It was one of those experiences that I feel like my breath was taken away and I'm just catching it back now.
Yes. Totally. So talk to me a little bit about like the march in general, like just for people who couldn't be there, maybe, you know, describe the scene. You know, what was it like to be there in D.C.?
I found it to be a very magical experience, an alchemy of a lot of different worlds coming together, a lot of different voices coming together for a cohesive message.
Yeah, and there was this criticism that there are no set demands. There's too many, like, different demands. Like, women don't know what to do next. And I thought that this sort of missed the point, because to me, this really felt like a moment for mass catharsis, almost. And I also just don't think that every action needs to have, like, here's our policy agenda, right? Like, it can just be this moment of, you know, solidarity and excitement.
I 100% agree with you. I feel that we've gotten into the habit and practice of undermining women specifically, or people of color, nitpicking righteous agendas by saying, oh, it's not going to be effective, or I wouldn't have done it this way. And the knee-jerk reactions are always the same. So that's right. What one makes me suspicious of these sorts of critiques is we've heard them before. Anytime we try to build something, that these critiques come so easily, so swiftly, and so quickly, that it always makes me wonder, was there real analysis put into that critique, or is it just something that is always said to undermine our strength and force? This was just the beginning, and the march organizer said that we've only just begun. This was a day to show that we have strength in numbers, that our ranks are not just resigned to the so-called coastal elites.
Yeah.
This is happening from D.C. to Alaska to Antarctica to Nairobi, and that there's solidarity and support in large numbers and representative of a lot of different communities coming together. So for me, I think a lot of the critiques at their root are actually very cynical and are rooted in retrograde ideas about what it means to be powerful and what it means to movement build, which is why I think that the march was really successful, because it's turning on its head what we think of as what it means to be powerful.
Yeah.
And the way that this march came together and how people gelled and the collective voice that came out of it, I think actually really did put forth a clear agenda. People were saying in the media that the messages they were hearing were equal pay, reproductive justice and rights, equality in the workplace, ending sexual violence. And so there were messages that were coming forth. But the key and largest message, which was the most important message, was resistance.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is amazing and important to be celebrated.
Yeah, absolutely. And that Trump doesn't have a mandate. Absolutely.
Yes, yes.
So for all the wonderful things that came out of the march, there's always room for improvement, right? And, you know, you and I were talking before we came on about some of the barriers for people with disabilities that was going on in the march. So what are some ways that we can make sure in future actions that, whether it's, you know, protests on the street or online organizing or whatever it is, that all of our work is being really mindful of marginalized communities, whether it's, you know, trans people with disabilities, immigrant communities? What can we do better?
One thing that I think this march has shown us in all of the beauty and messiness of what happens when you bring so many people together is that when you put people in your leadership who reflect the communities that are most impacted, it impacts the entire experience and gives it more integrity and more power. And so they did have, after at first not having diverse leadership and then course correcting and then diversifying their leadership, unifying principles that were beautiful, but they still needed more work because there still needed to be more communities reflected. So I think that one of the things we need to work on, and I'm saying when I say we, I'm talking also about myself, is being more resilient about how we take feedback from communities that are impacted, and also how we share power and give people opportunities to help build with us to make sure that more people are included, and that makes us stronger. So for example, I believe that the critiques from the disability community were valid. You know, I am someone who's living with a disability. I was born blind in one of my eyes, and that disability didn't impact my mobility while I was there. But there were issues for me around vision and sight and print and all those sorts of things that I think people who don't see the world literally the way that I do would not necessarily think about. And so I do think that by doing community audits, surveys, putting people in leadership, asking communities what they need, getting funds and support to help invest in those resources to make sure that more people can be there. Yeah. Super important. And also just recognizing, too, that those extra steps that it takes to be more inclusive actually help all of us.
Yeah.
And if we're going to say we're marching intersectionally, then we need to make sure that everybody is taken care of.
Sort of building on that, you know, I was posting pictures of signs on Instagram throughout the day. And one of the signs I posted a picture of was a white woman holding up a sign that said 53% of white women voted for Trump. Mm. And the comment section became sort of terrible and quite defensive from Trump supporters, but from white women who supported Clinton, who were very offended by the sign. And it was so difficult because that is the truth, right? And we do have to, white women do need to organize, not just among our like-minded friends and family, but we do need to have those conversations with the Trump supporters, the white women in our lives who are Republicans. Like, that's part of the action that we need to take and the organization that we need to do. How can we make sure that messages like this are sort of propped up and taken with the spirit in which I think that they're given, which is like the spirit of love and trying to get people to do great work?
Yes, I think that what I loved about those sorts of signs is that it was about a real righteous accountability to say, we need to do better and we expect better and we deserve better. And I think what I've heard from some of the white women I've talked to about this, or when I've mentioned that same statistic in certain spaces and had people push back, they'd say, well, not this white woman.
Right, exactly.
And it moves back to that dangerous exceptionalist narrative that we love so much in this country as well, where people think, oh, well, it's about me and my individual good deeds.
Yeah.
But there are systems in place that are literally killing people that we all feed into based on conditioning and institutional connection to harmful institutions that just can't be erased, no matter how much we think that we're more progressive than that or that our individual vote should carry the weight of defining our character and who we are. I think for people of color, we have for a very long time bared the brunt of being defined by the acts of individuals who may think about politics differently than us or have different points of views, but because we are Black or because we are Muslim, that we are therefore expected to carry the burden and the mantle for the entire community. And I think that this is new for white women.
Yeah.
So this has been really interesting for me to see like this awakening that some white women are having around racial justice as well as their privilege. And I think it's really hard for people to come to terms with the fact that they may be getting defensive because of their own complicity, and that accountability is not easy, and it's not like going to the spa. It is painful.
It's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable.
Yes.
And you said something earlier that I think is really important. It's, you know, that we have to be resilient in the face of people sort of, you know, I think lovingly calling us in on when we do stuff like that. You know, on Saturday night after the march, I tweeted out, you know, during the march, there were no arrests. Right. And so I tweeted out like a throwaway statement like, oh, look, things go so well when women are in charge. The next morning I woke up and I had very correct criticism saying, listen, that dismisses the way that racism functions in protests. And why do you think there were no arrests at this march? Because the march was largely white women. And, you know, it made me uncomfortable and it was painful, but that's sort of beside the point. And I think what can be helpful when we get called out or called in that way is to remember that someone is spending their activist energy on you. Activist energy is a really precious resource, right? And the fact that someone would take time out of their day to teach me something, I think is really an act of kindness and an act of love. And I think if we can think of it in that way, it can sort of move us from defensiveness.
And it's beautiful. I love the way you said that, because I think a lot of times we feel like if we receive that sort of criticism that it's defining of who we are as people and a defining of our character. But it's really about people wanting us to do better so that all of us do better. And that's something I try to remember when I get critiqued. And I'm glad you mentioned the arrests, because one of the things that I thought about with this march was that I felt like I would be more of a target because I would be at a march with a lot of white women, and that if arrests were made, that people of color would be the people who would be more at risk. Sure. And when we look at excessive force by police and state violence and all of those statistics, that is supported by fact. And so that, to me, was really interesting to see that there wasn't much dialogue about what that would mean. And I read something where someone said something like, by talking about this arrest, the lack of arrests, we need to make sure that we don't note that that was a day that the police state decided not to approach it in a different way, and it was because white women were there.
Yeah.
And I think it's really hard for people who are not yet fully understanding about how these systems work to recognize that they do have that level of privilege, that the people who might say, well, if you follow the law, then you won't be harmed or attacked, for them to actually change the worldview that they've been taught their whole life, that police keep you safe and that police treat everybody fairly, that's not the experience that a lot of us grew up with. So that needs to be discussed more. So I'm really glad that you brought that up and glad that we can have these sorts of conversations. And I'm hoping that the march and the people who came together and met each other, who might not have had opportunities to engage, will continue to have those conversations in their communities and with their families.
Absolutely. I hope so, too. So, you know, for a lot of people at the march, this was their introduction to activism, right? Like maybe for a lot of people, this was the first protest they've ever been to. Do you feel hopeful that for those people that they'll continue to be engaged, right? That they'll continue to take action?
I believe that people are ready to go. And the fact that they were able to come together, like what you were saying, and see that they're not alone is going to just energize people to help build this momentum moving forward. I've received several emails and Facebook tags with people saying, okay, I marched and now I'm energized. What's the next step? What's the plan? How can I take action in my community? And seeing all of the people who are responding to these calls for saying, hey, help me be accountable. Help me do this locally. It's really exciting. I think that people really know what time it is and the urgency.
Can you give us some examples of the kinds of actions people might take to keep the momentum from the march going?
Yes. So one first thing to do, if you were inspired by the march or you were marching, go on the Women's March website, womensmarch.com, and look at the 100-day plan and take the actions that are there. Also visit Swing Left and take the actions that are there. Call your senators. Just put it in your phone right now. Your senators, your congresspeople, they are your best friends right now. Put them up on your priority list on your phone. Be ready to call them every day. Be ready to stop sessions. Tell them that we will not take a repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Tell them about how it affects your life. I, as someone who lives with chronic conditions, has been calling daily, letting them know about the important life-saving care that I have received from Planned Parenthood, as well as the life-saving care that I've received as a result of being a member of the Obamacare plan in the New York healthcare marketplace. So it's really important for us to be doing that every day. And also take to your streets. Organize marches in your communities. Organize people in your communities for consciousness-raising groups. Mm-hmm. Our foremothers had consciousness-raising groups in the 60s, and we need to be doing that now. Jessica Bennett's book, Feminist Fight Club, has kind of our newer version of that. Yeah. But I think that we really need to have that in a time of gaslighting.
Yeah.
We need to come together and say, no, what is happening is real. This is not normal, and we are going to organize. And so there's a lot of things we can do. And I also think it's really important for us not to be distracted by shaming each other for whatever tactics we choose, but to think that there's so many different ways we can take action that we just need to make sure we are doing them and that we're doing them consistently and making sure that we're supporting each other in those tactics. We're going to need an inside and outside strategy to win this. And we're also going to need everyone leveraging their strengths and their networks to take our republic back.
Yeah. So what can we do, right, as folks who have been doing this for a long time to help them or to direct people who are maybe looking for advice on how to get involved? Like, how can we ensure that the march is not the last piece of activism that they do.
I think that we need to continue having conversations like these, surfacing and also highlighting the work of marginalized communities and their issues and connecting them to broader movements and connecting them to also some of the buzzwords we're hearing in the media that also encompass different local issues. We need to run for office as well as take action and take back local legislatures. We need to push back against gerrymandering and really illuminate the kind of threats to the Republic that have been happening and make sure that they don't continue to get worse.
Yeah.
And we also need to hold the truth to the light. Ida B. Wells had said that to us, and really make sure that in this time of so-called fake news and so-called alternative facts, that we are constantly pushing back against spin, against conspiracy, and against falsehoods that really undermine our voices. And creating our own media, I think, is a big part of that, too. Social media, they can say all they want about the crowd sizes being less than what we said they were. They can say all they want about whether or not half of the groups of people that were there were Trump supporters, which was not true for any of us who saw it in person, to be able to say, well, here's actually the picture that I took on social media that showed the reality. The numbers don't lie. And taking our own headcounts and taking matters into our own hands, I think, is what is the opportunity that we have right now and what ultimately will help us build, because as press freedom is continuing to be threatened.
Yeah. So what is WAM doing right now?
Yes. We're organizing locally in our chapters across the U.S. and in Canada. We are also working to uplift the writing and media and thought leadership of the women media makers in our community and trans media makers, gender nonconforming media makers, so that people know which voices to follow and know where to get their information. We're also working with our coalition to stop attacks on freedom of speech and freedom of expression related to online harassment, as well as surveillance. So right now our coalition is pushing back on Facebook for unfair moderation practices that disproportionately target people of color, but do not hold white supremacist groups as accountable, for example. And we have seen them in their recent hirings also take a much more conservative, neoliberal bent in terms of who they are bringing onto their news team.
Right.
So we are watching and we are acting and we are also bringing to light those stories. And it's really important and working harder than ever now to find collaborators who are doing the same work. What I think is an opportunity that this 11-9 aftermath has brought us is that we are more cohesive within our coalitions and that we have more common goals. And so that's a real important thing to me as an organizer, is to say, how can I be deepening partnerships and showing the work of other people with more integrity and more force? Because at the end of the day, we have to work together and we have a common enemy.
Absolutely.
And a common threat.
Absolutely. Speaking of that common threat, you were tweeting about this yesterday, and so as I, you know, it was like less than 48 hours after the Women's March, Trump reinstated the global gag rule, which is also called the Mexico City policy. For people who don't know, it prevents U.S. funding to international organizations that not only provide abortion, but it prevents them from referring women to other organizations that provide abortion or even mentioning abortion whatsoever. And, you know, activists who have been doing this for a long time know that the global gag rule has been responsible for, you know, thousands of deaths across the world and, you know, impacts maternal mortality in a really significant and dangerous way. Can you talk a little bit about why this? I mean, we knew that he was going to reinstate this. It was not a surprise. But I think it happening so soon after the march also felt pretty difficult to me. What do you think?
It felt like retaliation to me. And, you know, I think looking at the photograph that has been retweeted of all of these white men signing this into law without the people who are going to mostly be affected and impacted and harmed by this policy was bone-chilling. I was especially brokenhearted because when I worked at Planned Parenthood, we were fighting to make sure that the global gag rule was repealed because this was directly impacting our work, and we were seeing its risk to women's lives and seeing that women were dying from lack of access to safe medical care. Yeah. Abortion care is health care. And so that, to me, it felt like retaliation. It felt like a lashing out from seeing. And it also felt like hypocrisy, because he said in his inauguration speech that his presidency was going to be about putting power back into the hands of the people. And we saw the will of the people on Saturday, not just in the USA, but around the world, who were impacted by these policies. And he directly undermined that with this decision. I also think what happened that I want to name is going to show us about what real solidarity means right now. So there were some progressives, and including Bernie Sanders, who praised President Trump for the transatlantic partnership, or trans-Pacific partnership, decision that he made, but had been silent in that moment about the global gag rule. And so when we hear about the so-called identity politics rhetoric, and that we need to stop talking about these issues, that it's only about class, that we need to embrace a populist message and pander to people who would undermine and hurt us, I reject that. And I really want to name it, because I think that it made me really sad to hear the silence from some people who were retweeting pictures of Bernie Sanders on Saturday being at the Women's March, but also retweeting him on the day that the global gag rule is being repealed to praise him about the TPP and to say, yes, this is exactly why we need so-called identity politics.
Right.
Because these white men are playing a game of so-called identity politics, and that is how they used it to take our republic.
Yes. That was such a great note to end on, because I couldn't agree more. And it's so, I mean, we saw this again and again, and we saw this under the Bush years, this idea that, that women's rights, you know, like, just don't worry about it. Like, put it to the side for right now. We have bigger issues to focus on, and throwing our rights under the bus again and again in the name of progressive politics. And I think if Saturday was anything, it was a indication that we're not going to stand for it from the right or from the left.
Absolutely. I just, I loved that. I mean, just seeing the intergenerational energy also, that we're saying that not in our name, we are not going to stand for it. Next generation deserves better than this. And the generation who fought for us to have the rights, they deserve for us to maintain them and fight for them with all of our might. And that was the thing that I really took from it, too, was just like, we have got to fight for this, not just for ourselves, but for the next generation so that they will know freedom.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Jamia.
Thank you.
Jamia Wilson, activist and executive director of Women, Action, and the Media. That's it for this week. What Would a Feminist Do? Is produced by Maggie Freeling. Katie Enders is the supervising producer. Our intro song is by Rook Day. If you like this podcast, please take a minute to rate us and leave a review on iTunes. It helps to get the word out to others that What Would a Feminist Do? Is something they should be listening to. I really appreciate it. I'm Jessica Valenti for The Guardian. I hope you'll join me again soon for What Would a Feminist Do?